This is the seventh episode of Walk About and Find Up, and today I'm talking to Aaron Poppat, who at a young age already has experience as an exited founder, a venture capitalist, and is now working at Omnia, a company which raised a $50 million Series B round last year. I'd also like to apologize for the darkness in the back of the screen, but time differences leave no choice here. Before we talk about all those things I just mentioned with Omnia and venture capital, I thought I'd actually start the conversation or interview by steering away from work and talking a little bit about music and more specifically Orientation Records, which you are the co-founder of. So I was wondering if you could just give a quick summary of how that came about.
Yeah, sure. And thanks for taking the time to ask me these questions. It's a very fun thing to do. So basically, yeah, Orientation Records was born, I think, like coming up to a year and a half ago now. More officially and openly, like a year ago, right? And essentially, I have spent a lot of time in my life in and around music, full stop. And the love for electronic music started to grow around the age of sort of 14, 15, with the classic sort of like UK style, starting with jungle drum and bass and moving your way into kind of the genre that either you stay there or you move to the genre that you kind of enjoy, which I know you've got a lot of experience with as well. And yeah, I kind of at some point after COVID really landed quite heavily on techno. And so in a kind of way, it was where I found a lot of good cultural spaces for me to get involved in, and it's where I found a lot of identity. And when I was made redundant from my first job, or laid off, I don't know what the right term is, but yeah, they cut my team basically. I decided I wanted to spend some time where electronic music was kind of the focus of the place, and so spent some time in Tbilisi for a bit and then went to Berlin and really met a group of people that were kind of my people. And part of that journey led to me and my friends sort of sitting together and being like, well, we really love this music. And we believe there's kind of a market where there's a lot of timeless music being produced that isn't being released in a sort of timeless way, right? So we decided to kind of venture out and make our own record label, with a vinyl first approach, specifically focused on dance music with a timeless element, and that was kind of the birth of it. And we had an unbelievably lucky strike that one of our best friends is, in my opinion, one of the best producers maybe in techno globally. Like, he's so good. And so he was willing to release up the first record, and that went incredibly well and kind of oriented, funnily enough, the philosophy for the label. So yeah, that's kind of how it came about.
Would that friend be Take Arrow by any chance?
Caro, yeah.
There's the so my I listened to the releases on the label, and there's a track called Hide Side. I don't know if you would. It's like proper deep techno.
Oh
I loved it.
yeah. He's really special. Yeah.
Yeah, I think something that's really makes electronic music different to other genres is that sort of DIY attitude you can have, because there are just so many like independent operators out there on like the label side, the party side. I've been more involved on the party side, but I'd love to get involved more with labels, especially physical releases. I think that's such
Yeah.
also in such like a golden age at the moment as well. They're
Yeah.
doing really well.
The love for it, right? That's electronic music at its heart. Like, we lose so much money, but
Yeah,
that's
that's
kind of
very
like the
true.
point, right? And that's what's really fun about it. And like, it's something I want to make clear. It's like not a business. It's not a good business
Yeah.
decision. It's a decision that comes from somewhere else, right?
No, definitely. I know it firsthand. We're actually putting on an event tomorrow night in Peckham, and we just haven't been able to move tickets at all. But at the end of the day, like, we're booking DJs that are really rates and we're paying them, and I don't know. It's just, as you said, it's an ecosystem that isn't very rewarding financially, but in other ways it is. I think techno especially, I think it has like a very strong community feel, which I think you touched on a little bit earlier there.
Totally agree.
So being in both Tbilisi and Berlin, I think a lot of people like to group those two cities together. Do you think that's fair in terms of like music and culture?
No, Yeah, I understand it, right? Like, I totally get it, right? Like, I imagine, I guess, in a lot of ways, and this is like, I'm not trying to push on anyone's cultural ideas or whatever, but I imagine there's a world where Tbilisi probably reflects maybe what Berlin looked like after the fall of the wall a bit more. I think Berlin has become, for good reason, I think it's an awesome place, right? Like, I lived there for a year and a half. I would call it like home away from home. Tbilisi is a bit more like dance for resistance, like in a phrase, whereas like Berlin is a lot more trendy, a lot more cool now. It's got like that very fashionable aspect to the music. And there is certainly like a freedom fighting aspect to Berlin, but you can feel in the heart of what's going on in places like Bassiani and Hidi that it's deep there, there's a real fighting spirit, and that is like the core difference. And obviously there is alternative in Tbilisi, but Berlin is just it's not even comparable to anywhere else in terms of like the alternative aspect that you get to it. So very, very, very different places, very, very different cultures, both rooted in a similar start point slash reasoning behind it, right? So that's kind of my answer to that. But I mean, you've been to Tbilisi and
Interesting.
Berlin, right? You've been to both.
I've never been to Berlin, so I can't compare that. I know I need to go, but Tbilisi was a really cool experience. I've spent about 3 weeks in the rest of Georgia before coming to Tbilisi, so it was very interesting to see that like provincial urban divide. Like I didn't see graffiti anywhere in Georgia, and then you go to Tbilisi, and it's like you can't walk down the street without seeing at least, I don't know, five tags.
Yeah, it's the heart of the resistance, right? Like that's what Tbilisi feels like. Yeah, I won't go too deep into the politics, but look it up for 1 second. You get why Tbilisi is like what it is, right?
There was a documentary that the BBC ran about whether the police used tear gas unbeknowingly on protesters. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
But yeah, well, again, anyone listening, I highly recommend reading some dogs in the background. Reading up about it. Yeah, I live near Rustaveli Avenue, and this is the main street in Tbilisi, and every single evening people have been protesting, and I think it's up there with Hong Kong for one of the longest continuous protests. So what you're saying about like hearing resistance in the music, I think
And
that's very
look, right,
present.
speaking like very candidly, the clubs are part of that resistance, right? Like that's the difference in the culture of music. Like I get that the clubs are involved in Berlin, it's really cool, but in Tbilisi, they are the organizers, right? The techno community there, electronic music community, is completely intertwined with the resistance movement. And shout out to, great people like at DJ Community Studio and the guys at Fabrica and stuff like that. Like they're really orchestrating something that's incredibly important, right? So part of the deal.
Would you say that appeals to you more than Berlin then?
That's a good question. In a lot of ways, yes. Just because I think my personality, as you may get to understand over this interview, is quite like raw, right? I mean, we've spoken a couple of times before. I imagine you probably feel that a bit. So yeah, there's a certain like rawness which I like appeal to. But like Berlin is just fantastic, right? Like the people there are so open, so interesting that I got to like hang out with and explore. I understand there's obviously different sides, different cities. The heart of Berlin like still is not dead, and it's just such a beautiful thing. So I think day to day, Berlin's significant a bit easier, but realistically, I think Tbilisi's got a bit more soul right now, and certain parts of my life I want one, some parts of my life I want the other. Maybe I can live between both. I don't know, but they're both amazing, right? So.
It's a testament to your rawness, because Berlin is still a pretty raw place for I think a lot of people in the world. So,
Fair enough. Yeah.
yeah, fair play there. In Berlin, I think it's worth mentioning as well that you had a gig as well through orientation at the Fitzroy Club. What was it like DJing to a Berlin crowd? I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, that was a really fun event because it was supposed to be like family and friends, and it just did really well in terms of ticket sales and like my promoting stuff. So ended up being nearly a packed out venue. It was awesome, like, because for me, firstly, because it was our record release party, it was like our party, you know? So it's like we came to, like, I moved to Berlin and I was able with my friends and locals to be able to put together something that spoke to actually the city. So we felt really integrated, right? What it felt like to play, I mean, like, people fucking dance in Berlin, right? And it just feels good that you're being judged heavily always, a lot more than maybe a lot of other crowds, but the reward is just so sweet when you see people move in motion and stuff like that. It's just amazing to see, right?
No, I've heard fantastic things. And now you've moved from Berlin back to London, but my understanding is that you've also brought Orientation Records with you. Is that fair to London?
Kind of. So we're like now split. So there's four of us that now do it, right? And we're split between like London, Marseille, Paris, and Berlin. So
Oh,
it's like
wow.
kind of a
Okay.
first operation. It all started in Berlin, and then like one by one, we kind of like split for different reasons. So I would say like the heart still beats in Berlin of the record label. Like we still get our vinyl pressed at Man Made by Marine, who Ben Abu, she's awesome. Anyone's looking to get their vinyl mastered, like go with her.
Niche markets, but
Yeah, exactly. But like, but in Berlin, it's really competitive, right? So, you know, go to Marine, she's the best. But yeah, basically, it's still got that heart there, and that's will still be in priority Berlin record stores because that's where we sell the best because that's what our music speaks to. But yeah, it's completely fair to say it's a bit more separated out now. The next party should be in London, for example. So,
Okay, cool. Would you say you distribute a lot to record stores, or is it mainly directly to consumers?
oh, mostly to record stores. Yeah. So it's basically like, it's kind of, I mean, you'd have to talk to Julianne about this, but it's basically centered around we distribute through Triple Vision and
Okay.
then from Triple Vision, there's kind of like these routes by which you get into record stores, or we can just go to directly to record stores and they can order from the Triple Vision like system. I don't really know how it works exactly. I know we're in a lot of record stores. I know we also did a lot of
Yeah.
direct labels, but like our main focus would be that we can just put out a record and not have to promote it that much ourselves, and record stores know our name and then they just buy it and then it gets done in the secondaries market, right? That's like the goal. So
Yeah, I asked because, and actually, I feel like I should probably talk to you a little bit more off this interview, but I'm currently looking at that problem for independent labels and how they get their records out into record stores, because in Germany it sounds like you have a little bit of an ecosystem there, but in the UK you have these distributors that take basically all the profit out of it. But
well,
as
yeah,
you, yeah.
it's still kind of like that, right? But I think, mate, like my best piece of advice for that, just fucking turn up, like just go to the store with a bunch of records. They have real estate, and if your
Yeah.
music is good, record like the guys who run record stores are massive heads, right? They're not business
Yeah.
people typically. They just love having great music in their store. So if you turn up and it fits with what they want, they're gonna buy some off you, right? And I think that's like been one of the most beautiful things. We've just turned up to record stores and been like, have a listen. Like they put on the record. We come back 20 minutes later or however long it takes, hour later, and they're like, yeah, 100% buy this, right? And it's amazing. So
Yep, sometimes cold messaging in person, you can't beat
yeah,
it.
just turn up, man. Just turn up. If you want something, knock on the door, right? Like
Have you visited a lot of record stores since you've been back in London, or is it still on the to-do list?
not really, mate. Like work has been good. It's been good, but it's very busy. So it's just a very different process. Also, like I don't have many of the physical records here, thanks
Yeah.
Brexit. So like a lot of them I just end up like posting out for different deliveries. So I don't have many of them left. And there's not many left overall actually from that first press, which is great. But I know that we're putting a few more into Berlin record stores, and they've got some refreshing of their stock and stuff like that. So it makes more sense for them to be there, basically.
Nice. I really like going to a record store as a pastime, but I often find that you have to do it. Like, you need to take a day off work to do it, because if you go on like a Friday or on the weekends and there's only like one or two turntables and there's like 15 people that want to listen
Yeah, exactly.
to what they're buying, if it can be a bit of a nightmare. So
Yeah.
yeah, I can understand how work gets in the way. Which can be a tangent as well to Omnia,
Yeah,
which is
sure.
changing procurement at an enterprise level with an AI-powered platform
Yeah.
that simplifies the whole process. And as I mentioned, there was also a big Series B round last year, led by Insight Partners and Cosla Ventures as well. You joined Omnia around the same time as well. What made you make that decision?
I think I can speak to like three core points. I've answered this question quite a lot in my life. The
Okay.
first was like a personal thing, which was I was doing a lot of freelance consulting work in Berlin, like helping startups grow their operations. Specifically, for example, for a company called Heyroom, where I was helping like a lot of consumer brands grow. And that was great, but like I kind of needed another step into my career to like push some trajectory, and I wanted to learn the hard set of skills that comes with selling. And Omnia offers that in abundance, right? And so that's the first thing. The second thing was kind of being convinced, right? Like I went through the interview process and genuinely was so impressed by everyone at the company that I interviewed with that even though I was in other processes, they kind of just fell away in my mind. It was kind of a no-brainer that that was something I wanted to do. Is just essentially a belief in the space that the founders had picked the right pace to build, things were growing quickly, and that in the long run, this would be the right place for me to be in order to build the skills I wanted to for my future career, essentially.
Okay, interesting. So there's sort of three points there to paraphrase. One is that you've already had a bit of experience in VC, so that kind of made sense to work on the startup side. Second being obviously talent at Omnia. And then the third one being the, wait, sorry, I've already forgotten.
Like the market and the propensity to grow into the role that I would want to have in the long run, basically.
Okay. Got you. So almost like the sort of career ladder a little bit and
Everything,
looking.
exactly. Trajectory
Okay.
question, right?
Yeah.
So
And as an early career professional, how would you rank those three? Like, which one do you think should be top, or is it a mixture of all three of them?
so this is really interesting because I actually do a lot of mentoring for students
Yeah.
and people who want to get into like high performing careers or master's programs. And I think there's basically like two things that I wish I indexed my career on more at the beginning. The first one is the talent density piece, but like specifically focused on mentorship. If you can find mentors in your early career, you're just going to do really well because you're going to grow into the role or grow into your own skin. In a way that makes sense for you. And then the second thing is, I think I kind of debate myself about this quite a lot, but I think it's probably true. In your early career, it's good to do things that, especially if you're not a technical person, right? Like me, like I'm a generalist, right? It's good to do things that build the skills that open a lot of doors. And I don't mean just like keep doing that forever, but I knew that if I was here, I would learn what it's like to be an operator across like a number of different aspects. And that would allow me in the long run to be a founder, be a VC, you know, do the kind of things and see it from the angles that I wanted to. It's the same reason I did investment banking before as well. And also like, there's definitely a point about previous to this, having been at Rothschild, I was able to take a bit of a leap. Into a bit more of a niche space, which I was really happy about. So I would also advise getting some good grounding in your early career can just be so helpful because you have the confidence of a springboard to do well, basically.
And I suppose you have a little bit of a badge as well, you could call it.
Totally, yeah, totally. Makes a big difference, yeah.
Yeah, my previous question, I asked it because you look at your career and you've touched on it there, but you've already worked on the VC side, investment banking side. Now you're in a startup. Do you think it's in a startup environment that, as an early career professional, you can get those sort of conditions that you were talking about?
Look, I think the startup environment thing, it's just so variable, man. Like I've worked in a lot of
Okay.
startups and freelance for a lot. I just think like this idea that all tech is the same is just not like at the end of the day, right? Like in a lot of ways, something like banking has had a lot of time to homogenize the kind of culture they want to have, right? So, okay. Obviously, it's going to be different from like a Goldman to a Rothschild to a JP Morgan, right? Like 100%. However, in tech, like Every founder, because the founder is so much closer to, or not in tech, but in startups, right? It's not always just tech. The founder is so much closer to the operations they want to run that their goal and their culture, it directly comes from the top. So it's massively mission aligned. I would say a startup is a great place to learn these things, but there's also definitely value and knowledge at the very, especially at the early stages of your career, to be in a bigger institution. And I also think, I know this is a bit stupid or like not very helpful, but like it's, there's not a one size fits all answer to the question. I'd have started at a startup before. I wouldn't have been mature enough, and I would have messed up a lot of things, like I did when I was a banker. But it was a lot more forgiving, even though being a banker is hard. It's more forgiving because like you're a bit more of a cog in a machine, whereas here I'm a lot more autonomous. So if I mess up, I'm the one who has to pay for it, right? And I couldn't have done that when I was 22, but now I'm mature, more mature in my career steps, and I feel more confident that I can do my own thing and actually perform, right?
Yeah, no, that does make sense. And I suppose you have that sort of safety net of experience at Rothschilds to then take on a
Exactly.
lot more responsibility at
Qualifications and
Omnia.
stuff as well, right? Like it does make a
Yeah.
difference.
And you sort of said there that each startup kind of has a brings a different vibe or different energy depending on their CEO. What would you say is Omnia's energy coming from Ben Freeman?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to speak about like exactly what's coming from Ben Freeman, right? But I can tell you what my day-to-day is, which is it's intense. And it's a massive like winning mentality. And the idea is like work hard and have a high velocity at all times. And if you do that, like you will succeed, basically. And there's a lot of infrastructure in place for people to do well, and there's a collegiate atmosphere, like we're in this together. But there's a certain like realism and pessimism about what it's like to really grow a business. And we're all part of that like growth mindset. So it's just super high velocity is the best way of putting it.
Okay. And how does that high velocity sort of manifest itself in your job day to day?
It means that I feel personally responsible for the success of the company and also personally responsible for the success of myself. Whereas when you're at a bigger institution or a place that like maybe works long hours or like, you know, for example, corporate law or whatever it is, like you work long hours and you're working hard. But the reason I use the word velocity is because the growth and the impact that you make day by day is just like completely incomparable, right? So that's how it translates.
Okay, and would you say your job mainly revolves around sales? Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
So presumably it's just a lot of outreach, a lot of networking that you're sort of involved in, or would you say it's a bit
Yeah.
broader than that?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, there's a lot of literature on go-to-market versus sales, selling as a function of building, all these things. At the end of the day, like, my job revolves around like a few core things, which is one, obviously, just like standard cold outreach, you know, whatever you want to, whatever nice or not so nice words you want to put on that. As you said, building a wider network to like create opportunities, but also like being enterprising about how you use company resource to like push the brand and make sure you're top of mind, right? And I think that's like the trick a bit more is like understanding your market, understand like I work in the Nordics. I understand the market really well, which is what makes me successful, and I understand how people tick there, and I understand how to build wider networks and community there, right? Which like allows for it to work out. I know that's very jargony, but it kind of is just true. If you just spend your day like generating random pipe, it just doesn't really work. So
And sort of with those things such as called insight, for example, do you feel like previous experience in maybe founding or venture capital helps, or is it actually learning a lot on the job at Omnia?
definitely a lot of learning on the job. I think the previous experience is more just it's relying on that, as I said, like that baseline of maturity, right? It's like I am confident in my ability to hold my own and work through these things and just get it, you know?
Yeah, and Omnia gives you the space to do that as well,
You got it.
then.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm conscious that there's sort of limited probably in answering this question, but what are the next rough steps for Omnia, if there are any that you can expand on?
Yeah, it's build a $1 billion business, right? Like that's it.
Okay. And you're looking at procurement all across all sorts of industries in order to achieve that as well,
Yeah,
then.
so we're industry agnostic, right? So we can any company that has a desire to make procurement systems more efficient can use us. That's it. Specifically on the indirect side, if you want to get technical about it, but yeah.
So from a sales point of view, do you think that agnosticism makes it easier or harder?
So there are obviously like companies that I think this agnosticism thing, like it's a really good question because you can build a $1 billion business like tracking pizza, right? Like it's totally possible. But it's not that we're agnostic in the sense of every company needs us. I think most companies could benefit from using us, but we're quite, there is like a specific focus surrounding questions of risk and questions of spend management that a lot of companies don't really have to deal with. So it's not necessarily like industry specific, but there is like a ideal customer profile specific. Does that make sense? So it's not as
Yes.
like awesome as it looks from the outside. Like for example, if you have a high software spend, you're much more likely to use Omnia because of like the kind of risks that come with having a high software spend. Or if you're a financial services company, like we have way more financial services logos than other industries, right? So there are verticals that are carved out that make more sense, and that comes under a criteria of the kind of companies that we should target.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's like quite an important distinction there between the sort of the general customer fits whilst also being open to a wide range.
Exactly.
Within that customer fits, in when we're talking about the size of the company, is there like a specific size, or again, is that sort of variable?
That's where I'd say it's like mostly agnostic. I mean, like realistically, you will get the most benefit out of Omnia if you have more than 500 employees, and that's basically like the only thing I'll say about that essentially.
Okay. Yeah, because it's a sort of service that's offered very much at like the enterprise level, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be. So, like, I mean, there's from logos wise, you've got Albertsons, which is like one of the biggest retailers in the world. All the way down to fintech startups with 600 employees, right? So, or scale ups, whatever you want to call that. Yeah.
Okay. Right, I think that's good for talking about Omnia. My third and last topic, because I'm conscious that you're busy and it's very dark here, is diversity in venture capital, which I've seen in various ways you've been quite involved with. In a Medium article written in 2023, you predicted that for the next 300 years, venture capital is going to center around the concept of bringing people together.
Yeah.
3 years on, do you still stand by this prediction?
That's really funny. I should probably take that down. Yeah, sure, why not? I think so those articles are things like basically that I was quite bullish on in terms of like general themes of investment. And what's interesting about them is they're pre-AI, right? So or like obviously AI
Okay, yeah.
existed pre like this AI boom. So it would be funny for me to go back and read over them because I was quite onto something in my mind about like decentralized systems and how like I was in this kind of like world of that, and like this community thing was like very I guess like pressing to me because we had like a massive loneliness problem after COVID. I actually do kind of believe that it's true because orchestrating people together, whether that's in the workspace or whether that's in like a more global sphere, will be the center of making things work, right? Like essentially, if you take the autonomous AI question out of the picture, the best use for tech is to make people better at what they do and therefore communicate better and work together better, right? Like this dot-com bubble gave rise to like a very lonely corporate box by which collaboration started to fall. And I think essentially a lot of the tools that exist are like pro collaboration, whether that's in the workplace or whether that's in just a more like general consumer sense. I would say that the the piece that I guess is like quite hard to negotiate in my brain now with that point is surrounding this sort of like idea of AI working for itself. I think, and I think actually philosophically, I was probably onto something when I wrote that because, like, will AI fuel the revolution of people wanting to be more close together? Right. I mean, if I pose the question back at you, like, what are the best things that anyone's ever achieved? One in 100 are by themselves. 99 out of 100 take a village, right? So if you think of that as like how you allocate capital, yeah, that should be the center of venture capital investment. But it's so airy fairy and so like philosophical, it's probably not true in terms of the way I want to speak about my concept of investment now.
Yeah, no, I understand. But it doesn't need to be like a full sort of like financial model that makes sense. I think that's what struck me about the articles. It wasn't really focusing on, the financial side. Although there was an economic argument there, but I think I've never heard the phrase corporate box, for example, about how tech can help challenge that. Do you think the corporate box has become stronger post AI, or are you suggesting that actually AI can help increase collaboration in the way that we work in the office?
It's a great question. Like, I think it's just, I think it can increase collaboration, but it's all down to culture, right? Like, you could get a tyrant at the top who basically just wants AI to like whittle its way through, just like gutting people at the company. Like, that completely can exist. I don't think that's a successful model. Maybe I'm not profit driven enough. I don't know. Maybe I need to rethink this. But yeah, overall, I believe in like AI best used as a collaboration tool, right? Like, across any system. Like, the best way that I use AI is to make my work easier so I can spend more time with the people either around me or prospects or speaking to customers so that I can understand what the hell they need, right? So it stops me from being on my own, smashing through Excel spreadsheets, smashing through decks. You know, AI just like uplifts my skill set so I can spend more time with the people so we can actually figure out what each other want.
Yeah, I think that's a more positive spin on it. I have a slightly more negative example from my own experience when working at Entrepreneurs First. If you spend enough time on LinkedIn, which I'm pretty sure you do, you've noticed that everybody at Entrepreneurs First has this like branded profile picture where you have to look to the left, like upwards, and there's some stupid corporate lingo about how it like symbolizes that you're a visionary or something like
Yeah,
that.
that's hilarious. Yeah, I've seen
But
that. They
in
did
the
this thing, analysis of the Swedish unicorn founders as well, right? With all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
In the past, or at least before I started using AI tools there, they would normally get a photographer. Photographer would come in for the day, and in a sort of not that it's the main goal of having a photographer in. I can imagine it's a situation where people from the company come together, stand in the queue together, talk to each other. There's a photographer there as well. When I started working there, we started using AI generative tools to basically take the pictures of people looking straight on, and then you can tell, like Nano Banana, which was the Google tool, still is, and you can tell it, oh, look 45 degrees upwards and to the left, and it does it perfectly. And I
Right.
remember it was a really weird feeling as somebody who had got their first corporate job to be like, I feel like I almost need to like take somebody else's job to make sure that I can keep mine.
Yeah.
And it put my head in a little bit of a spin about the sort of AI tools and how it's going to change the corporate world. But I think your example is so different to mine, and it goes to show, I think, as with a lot of tech stuff, that it is very case by case.
Yeah, look, I think on that anecdote specifically, right? I imagine at some point when you used to have a portrait drawn and then people brought in like digital cameras and analog cameras and stuff that like it was like, what's going on? Taking our jobs, right? But like that doesn't mean that painting stopped. I think like it will take, I think I totally get where you're coming from, that it will take a lot of the practicality out of some of the trades that we have. Yeah. Will there be corporate portrait photographers as much, maybe not, right? But equally, do I think that someone's really going to want their wedding photos taken and edited by AI? Right? Like, you laugh when I
Yeah.
say it. Maybe some people will, but
Well, definitely
it
not
always,
by me, that's for
yeah,
sure.
exactly. Yeah, I think there'll still be an industry for that kind of thing for a very long time, right? People still get paintings done at their weddings. You know what I mean? And that's, yeah, like technology moves forward. It replaces different jobs, and that's just how it is. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not a good thing. Maybe it's not a good thing, especially in the creative world. Probably not, right? Probably not. But it's there, and you kind of have to be as creative as you can with moving forward with it, right? So, yeah. Hire proper photographers for your weddings and ask the things that you want, right? Shout out.
Yeah, there's a well, I guess the creator space is quite interesting. I don't know if you saw, I think it was about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, that Bandcamp flat out what's the word? Banned any music that had any parts of AI generation in it. So I'm wondering what your opinion is on that.
Yeah, great. Take a fucking stance, right? Like, if like, do I have a specific opinion about the validity of AI music? I do. I think it's kind of stupid, right? Because I think it basically means that music is for the listener, which is probably not as true now as it ever has been, actually, in terms of the way music is distributed and stuff like that. It's not really for the listener. It hasn't been, in my opinion, for quite a while.
Yep.
The listener finds what they like and then can dig into what's been made, right? You, as a creative, you put your art out and then see what people think.
Yeah.
So, like, the AI and music thing is kind of stupid because it sort of tends towards this idea that, like, okay, we have an ideal listener, and therefore, like, we can build a robot that tells, like, gives that listener the perfect thing to listen to. Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Listen,
Yeah.
that's, if you just want to listen to perfect music, listen to one song, right? That makes sense to you. Fine, sure. And it
Yeah.
all converges to this like point. So yeah, I'm pretty pro that. Also, like, obviously, Bandcamp is a place where a lot of independent artists live and where a lot of people make their entire living, right? So having AI essentially take over that as a platform. I mean, look at like any social media, which Bandcamp is, by the way. Bandcamp is a form of social media in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
Look at any social media. It's just flooded with AI slop, right?
It's horrible. It's
Yeah, so
horrible.
taking the stance of not doing that is probably a good thing.
What you're saying there about how we consume music and especially social media, the trending audio might be one of the worst things that's ever happened to music. It's actually, and then the moment that you start having trending audio that's charting and it's AI generated, it becomes so unbelievably far removed from music. It's not, it's just like,
Yeah,
it's
what I
sort
will
of.
say on that point, like, and maybe this is like unfair, and maybe it's just because I'm like an electronic music head, so sorry everyone. But I've always thought like there's a world where AI and tech takes the places of the jobs we maybe shouldn't have, right? And
Yeah.
I think essentially like a lot of labels and artists that create music, which is essentially just for creating trending music, which does exist, that whole industry exists, right?
Yeah.
That probably should be eradicated. So I'm not like hugely against AI just being all of the TikTok music and then
Yeah.
real musicians and creators existing outside of that. So then people actually have to put effort in to find decent music, and therefore like the spread of distribution just becomes better, right? Because now radio is dead, sadly. That's how people find their music, and the more that that gets polluted with noise, probably the better it is for independent music creators, right?
Yeah, there's
We're just,
ultimately.
we just need to get over the hump.
Okay, we're in the hump area right now, then.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think, I mean, we're in a transitionary period. It definitely feels like that. Although I might be saying that every 5 years for the rest of my life, who knows? I think what you're saying that originality, like originality can't be done by AI. That's the one
Yeah,
thing that it by default cannot do. And as you know, like a proper true piece of music should be original in some sort of interesting way. But in a way, it kind of it made me feel It made me feel a bit weird about the Bandcamp ban of music, because if you do feel that way, that only original music can be made by humans and only original music will be therefore rated on a platform like Bandcamp, then why do you even need to ban AI? And also found it a bit heavy-handed in the sense that if a song is 100% generated by AI, with, as you said, a prompt that's all about trying to, I don't know, maximize engagement, that shouldn't belong on Bandcamp. But what if it's you writing a song and you use, I don't know, ChatGPT as a sounding board for a lyric? Or if
Don't do
you're,
that.
don't
Don't
do
do
it
that.
at all.
Don't
No.
do that. No. Waste of time, waste of money, slippery slope. Like, just don't do it. It's fine. Call a friend, right? Like, it's cool.
So you stay away.
I just don't. I just don't think there's any need for it.
Yeah. Okay.
We
But in
don't need to
Krakoa.
make new We don't need to make making music more efficient, right? There's already enough music. Like, it can be a slow process, and that's fine, right?
Yeah, I do see that argument. But especially with electronic music, for a lot of people, it's very hard to get involved in that slow process. You need a laptop, you need Ableton, you need time.
It is what it is. We're all like, how many people are Ableton pirates? You know what I mean? Like, everyone's bloody Ableton. Like, come on, have some like gumption. Okay, sorry, you can't use ChatGPT to make music. Like, whatever.
Okay. So no AI music, definitely AI in procurements because it can definitely help there.
Exactly.
I
Totally.
want to ask one slightly different question on the diversity topic.
Yeah, go for it.
For a period of time, you helped write the newsletter for European Amela. Am I Amela or Amelie? Amela, sorry. Which is a focus on supporting female founders. How do you think we should tackle female underrepresentation in the world of startups? Because it is definitely present.
Wow, that's a loaded question. Right, let me give you some context as to why I was writing Amela. My friend Anais needed help from an English speaker at the time because the person who was writing it had left, and I was like, yeah, no problem, I can step in, help. As long as you need till you find someone like a woman to do it, essentially a female to do it, right? Answer the question of representation. I basically have a fairly simple opinion on this, which is there's a structural problem with female participation from a young age, and it's because there's essentially a culture of a patriarchal culture that permeates schooling. It permeates everything we see, but the fact that it permeates schooling means that we have to make active change from the very first day to make sure that women are participating consistently from a young age. So then we don't have to like battle these things down the line. And then when it comes to putting your hand up for jobs, putting your hand up for like representation, we don't have to overcompensate. Obviously, right now, there's no quick fix to this problem, right? Like, there's a lot of initiatives that I think are pretty good, probably to help this, Amela being one of them. But like, I think the more you can essentially just like empower women earlier on in the pipeline, in the professional pipeline, no matter what career that is, the more likely they are to participate. And that's the case with anyone, anything that's underrepresented, right? And so basically, just making people, men and women, aware of the fact that like it's okay for, not only okay, but encouraged for women to do all of the jobs in society is just like the most logical way to go about this. Banks or whatever, public companies slash whoever wants to run DEI initiatives, like get to the schools and offer them empowered training to help young girls and women understand what options there are for them and how best they can go about winning those seats, right?
Do you think it starts sort of at an educational level?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. But like, obviously, that's a really easy answer. So that's why I kind of support things like Amela, because it's like, right, there's clearly underrepresentation. We need to fix these things at all stages. They all make sense. It's very rare that I see one that I'm like, oh, that's really stupid, because there's a reason why it exists, because of underrepresentation. So But if you want structural change, if you want real change, you have to go to like entrenched structures. And entrenched structure, the only real entrenched structure we have in the UK, at least, is schooling, right? Like everybody goes to school. So.
Yeah. Would you say this is something that goes across all industries? Or would you say, I don't know, I feel like tech seems to have a bit of a culture problem more than other industries. I think you see, especially at the top,
Yeah.
with people like Mark Zuckerberg. I think last year he said that The Office lacks masculinity on the Joe Rogan podcast, and you can. Exactly, like it's, but there's a sort of, there's a little bit of a mold, I think, especially at the sort of executive level of tech. And whilst I you know, education and the sort of formative years of humans, I can definitely see it's very important. But do you think tech also is a bit of a an issue as an industry?
Depends how bottom line driven you are, right? Like, yeah, probably. I don't know.
Well, I am conscious that you have a busy day still ahead of you, probably. So let's wrap this up. Thank you for talking to me. We discussed a wide range of things, which is a testament to you as a person, Aaron. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Sasha. Really appreciate it, mate. And yeah, looking forward to catching up when you're done with all your travels.
Definitely. All right. Take care.
Out. Ciao.